the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, there's not a, well, I guess there actually is a lot in the news today. In fact, Stephen Cohen is going to drop by in our third hour to talk at some length about what's going on. The Russian economy is in free fall. President Putin held his press conference last night, and there was a bit of a change of language with regard to Ukraine. I'm curious about all this stuff. I want to find out what he has to say. Neil McCabe is going to drop by in our second. That'll be our third hour. Neil McCabe is going to drop by in our second hour, and we're going to have a conversation about factory farms. He likes them. I don't. But it's going to have a lot more depth than that. But to start out, and in a way, this is at the top of the news, and in a way, it's not. But I think it's a really, actually, a very important topic, even though some people think, oh, yeah, pot, you know. I'd like to talk about marijuana, and specifically medical marijuana, and specifically in that context, there's something called CBD, which I think is pronounced cannabidiol. And so, you know, if you know, feel free to call and correct me. This is not something that, I've known about THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, since I was a teenager. But the CBD in pot, or in cannabis sativa and indica sativa, or cannabis indica, I guess is what it is. I find this whole thing fascinating. I told you the story of when Louise and I went to Portland last Thanksgiving for Thanksgiving to, you know, spend with our kids. All three of our kids live in Portland. One of them actually lives in Washington State in Vancouver, and we were staying with him. And pot is legal there. And so Louise and I went to a pot store. I'd say, hey, we'd never been to a legal pot store. I mean, whoever would have known? And we used to smoke pot when we were teenagers, but, you know, we throughout our adult lives, we raised three kids. We've started five businesses, really successful businesses. We started seven. One went down in flames. One kind of didn't go anywhere. But, you know, we've been working our butts off most of our lives, and so we've not been sitting around smoking dope. But it was like, oh, this would be interesting. And I tried it, you know, a month or so ago when I was in Denver, too, tried smoking the legal pot there. But I told you about that experience, the guy who had bought it the day before, because the pot store is closed at 7 in Denver. And I was there for a board meeting, and I couldn't get out before that. So the guy who bought it, he had one brand. He says, this is the high THC, and the other one is the high CBD. And he said, so, well, let's try that. And we smoked both of them. And I ended up like, just, wow, I am pretty stoned here. And I need to go to sleep. And so I went up and I slept really, really well in my hotel room that night. And the next day flew home from Denver. When we went to Washington State in the legal pot store. Now, you know, Louise has had and we believe has successfully treated breast cancer. I went through this thing with prostate cancer. It's all solved. But it's like this whole thing about cancer and CBD is fascinating. And, in fact, here, this is a press release from PR Newswire. Press release. From a company, right? That's like, just telling the world. This is from 2012. It's on the PR Newswire. San Diego, September 21, 2012. The headline, Can Cannabidiol CBD Fight Metastatic Cancer? According to the latest research, the answer is yes. Now, this is a press release from a company called Medical Marijuana, Inc., and they're traded over-the-counter. MJNA is the symbol. And they say scientists at California Pacific Medical Center have been researching marijuana's compounds for the past 20 years, have found that cannabidiol, or CBD, has the ability to turn off the DNA that causes breast and other types of cancers to metastasize. It's the second most abundant cannabinoid in marijuana, but it does not cause the psychotropic high of THC. And then Pierre Desprez, one of the scientists, who, by the way, his current funding is coming from the National Institute of Health, the Susan G. Komen for the Cure, the U.S. Department of Defense, and the California Breast Cancer Research Program. And he says, we started by researching breast cancer, but now we found that cannabidiol works, CBD, works with many kinds of aggressive cancers, brain, prostate, any kind in which these high levels of ID1 are present. ID1 being an enzyme or a protein that promotes metastasis of cancers. So CBD in pot does not get you high. And in fact, one of the things I've noticed for years, I'm sitting here with a can of, a box, I guess it is, of Pacific brand all-natural hemp, non-dairy beverage. And there's a couple different brands that I've used over the years. And I use it as coffee creamer, and I have, about 4 tablespoons of oatmeal in the morning, and I put hemp milk on it. And what I've noticed is that when I take the hemp milk, I don't want to say I feel better, like smiling, because actually coffee does that to me. Coffee makes me chatty and, speed, right? But I have had pain in my back since I was 20 years old and broke my back skydiving. And that pain goes away. So I'm wondering, is there CBD in hemp milk? Because CBD is not the stuff that gets you high. And I'm drinking my hemp milk here. So am I doing the show high? Or at least with CBD? I don't know, but I find it fascinating. And the hemp actually has high in the fiber hemp. This is an article from the Schaefer Library of Drug Policy, druglibrary.net. It says cannabidiol, CBD, cannabidiol, a precursor chemical in the biosynthetic pathway of cannabis sativa, tends to exist in an inverse relationship with THC. In hemp fiber, where THC levels are very low, CBD levels are high. So, they breed pot with high THC to get people high. They breed pot with high CBD to relieve pain and stop cancer. And I'm looking forward to going back to Vancouver, Washington, next week for Christmas. And I had to leave my pot there, right? Because it's not legal to fly with this stuff. But we got this really high CBD pot, Louise and I, and we smoked it before we went to bed because we don't like being high during the day. And just slept like babies. And Louise has a neuropathy. She's got a pain problem that's associated with her chemo, the consequences of it. And it seemed to help dramatically with that. So I'm convinced this stuff is healthy. Now, the omnibus bill that just passed Congress says that the federal government cannot use money to interfere with states' medical marijuana programs. I think we're on the verge of a huge renaissance about this. There are over 60 known compounds in cannabis that are cannabinoids, that are in this family of things. Here's another. This is a completely separate research study published over at livescience.com. Pot smokers show less inflammation. And they're talking about C-reactive protein. This is a protein you can measure in the blood that as it goes up, your risk of heart attack goes up because it's a marker of inflammation. And inflammation causes hardening of the arteries or thickening of the arteries, and that causes heart disease. And they had these people into three groups, people who had never smoked pot, people who occasionally smoked pot, people who had smoked pot at least once in the past 30 days. The researchers found that the people who had smoked in the last month had the lowest CRP levels, had lower CRP levels than those who had never smoked the drug. Pot prevents heart disease?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And then the inflammation is also associated with cancer. I mean, this is how the uterine cancer and throat cancer from the herpes virus are caused. And welcome back. John, in Jarrett, Virginia, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, John, what's up?
Hello.
Pardon me while I sip my hemp milk while we're talking. So what's up? John?
You hear me okay?
I hear you just fine.
Hello?
You're on the air.
Okay, yeah, I know quite a bit about, I could probably answer any question you have about it.
Okay, here's my question. Am I getting CBD from this hemp milk?
Very possibly a small amount. Technically, if you drink a Coke or a Pepsi, there's a teeny, teeny amount of alcohol in there because, you know, the stuff ferments a little bit.
Right.
So, yeah, the little trace amounts is not a big deal. And the CBD is a good idea, but the idea that it's going to work better without the THC, I think that's ridiculous.
Well, I've seen several articles suggesting that the two compounds potentiate each other, that when you put them together, it's a synergistic, you know, equation, that the sum is greater than the parts, than the two, the added parts.
Absolutely. And they have evidence that pot cures cancer going all the way back to, I think it's 1976.
Oh, in the 1890s, pot tincture was being sold, you know, as a cancer cure and as a pain remedy and as a sleeping pill. I mean, it was you could buy it at Sears Roebuck and Company in 1930.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's absolutely true. For the first 100 years plus, there was no such thing as an illegal drug. You could get what was called laudanum.
Yeah, which was opium tincture.
Drugstore.
Yep.
You could get pure cocaine in any drugstore.
Yep.
And like that Sears catalog for pot. And at one point, you could even pay your taxes with marijuana. There were original settlers that came over here. They were encouraged by England to grow pot for paper making and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a bit long and rich history. And, yeah, actually, the government has known that it is medicinal. There were those people, at one point there were still 8 of them alive. I think there's only 1 or 2 alive now. They were the people that got pot from the federal government in the 80s under the Compassionate Use Program, which is, if you're going to die anyway, why would we not give you a medicine that might help you because, oh, well, this hasn't been tested.
Right.
So it was called the Compassionate Use Program. There was one guy, I think his name was Irv Rosenfeld in Florida that was getting that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any questions I can answer for you?
No, I think you're doing it. I mean, it's pretty straight.
They'll always say, oh, if you smoke.
Well, here's a question, John. Louise has been poking around the internet and found a company that says that they're selling hemp oil that's high in CBD and is legal to ship over state boundaries. Is that true?
Well, if it doesn't have the THC, it may very well be.
Yeah. Huh.
But there again, it works better with the whole shebang. There's actually like 60 different medically active chemicals that work together.
I understand. But then there's this thing about going to prison, which is not, you know, a fond side effect. John, thank you for the call. Thanks for the information. Great to hear from you. Nice to know we have experts. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. The other thing that was interesting, being in that legal pot store in Vancouver, Washington, was the, you know, just looking around. I sort of expected there to be a whole bunch of, you know, me when I was 20 years old, you know, a whole bunch of 20-somethings with long hair and tie-dyed T-shirts. And instead, I saw a fair number of people my own age, you know, boomers. One guy wearing a suit, others, one guy was dressed up like a construction guy. A couple of people were just, you know, normal street clothes. There were 2 elderly women, I mean, like over 70, who had come in together. I think the youngest people in the pot store were, frankly, the people who worked there. And this is the recreational pot store. The woman that we talked with, they've got like a sommelier, you know. She says, well, this has a lemony taste. This has a piney taste. This gives more of a head high. This is more of a body high. This relieves pain. This one doesn't. You know, she knew what she was talking about. And when Louise said, you know, well, we both said, actually, you know, we're looking for something that reduces pain and helps you sleep. You know, we're not looking to get blasted. We've kind of been there, done that, you know. Still have the T-shirt someplace. And she knew exactly what we were talking about. She said, you know, a lot of people come in here and they're not looking, and this is a recreational pot store because it's Washington State and it's legal. And she said, a lot of people come in here and they're not looking to get high. They're looking for relief of pain. They're looking for something that will reduce the probability of the cancer spreading, that might stop cancer in its tracks that they don't even know that they have, you know, prophylactically, preventatively. There's an article here, 5 must-know facts about cannabidiol, CBD. Number one, it's one of the 60 compounds that are found in cannabis. The levels vary from plant to plant, from very high levels to zero. Number two, it's not psychoactive. It does not get you high. Unlike THC, CBD does not cause a high. So it's a poor choice for recreational users. Although it makes, it does not act in the same pathways as CBD. These are the CB1 receptors in the brain. CBD has a wide range of medical benefits. This is the stuff that's apparently responsible or largely responsible for. Well, here's the list. Antiemetic. Right, this is why people use this when they're on chemotherapy. It's not emetic. An emetic is a drug that makes you barf and it makes you throw up. And which is what happens when people go through chemotherapy, particularly for you know, cancer. Well, I guess most people go through chemotherapy, do it for cancer. But in any case, the biggest complaint that people have is that they're so sick to their stomach all the time that, you know, they can't get out of bed and they don't feel like eating and all that. And pot makes that go away. And I don't know that from personal experience, but I know several people personally who have used pot to deal with the nausea of chemotherapy with incredible success, greater success than any prescription drug. Okay, so number one, antiemetic. Number two, anticonvulsant reduces seizures. I've never known anybody who used it for seizures, but we've all seen the news reports about this little girl in, I think it was Virginia, who had, you know, she was having 20, 30 seizures a day, and her family literally sold their home and moved to Colorado so that they could give her this high CBD oil that doesn't actually get you high. They give it to her with a couple of cc's in the mouth as an oil, and she takes it several times a day. It doesn't get her high, but it stops her seizures. Charlotte's Web, I think, is the name of the plant that they're growing out there for this stuff. That's number two. Number three, it's antipsychotic. It combats psychosis disorders. Number four, it's anti-inflammatory. Number five, it's an antioxidant. Number six, it's anti-tumoral, anti-cancer. And number seven, it's anxiolytic. In other words, it's an antidepressant. It reduces anxiety. And they're talking about in the UK, a company called GW Pharmaceuticals is right now doing clinical trials on CBD as a treatment for both schizophrenia and epilepsy. And another company in California, the California Pacific Medical Center, is hoping to begin clinical trials on CBD as a breast cancer therapy. Now, this was as of February 23rd of this year. So and they note that one of the real benefits of this is that there's no risk of lethal overdose. You know, if you take benzo drugs or if you take secanol, phenobarbital, what are those called? Barbiturates. If you take a barbiturate, these are typically the drugs that are given for seizure disorders. You take enough, it'll kill you. But with the pot, no one's ever died of an overdose of pot, ever, as far as anybody can tell. And number five, they say it is still illegal. CBD is classified as a Schedule I drug in the United States, a Schedule II drug in Canada. On the other hand, they note the U.S. Food and Drug Administration recently approved a request to trial a pharmaceutical version of CBD in children with rare forms of epilepsy. So, and according to the company, the drug consists of more than 98% CBD, trace quantities of some other cannabinoids, and zero THC. This is a drug called Sativex. It's been approved in 24 countries for treating multiple sclerosis. And by the way, the U.S. government, Health and Human Services, in 2003, got patent number 6630507 to use CBD, marijuana, to treat neurodegenerative and inflammatory disorders. This would include Alzheimer's, age-related dementia, heart disease, cancer, stroke. It's amazing. So I'm just learning about this stuff, and I think it's fascinating, and I wanted to bring you along on my learning excursion, because I think that there's exciting stuff going on here. If not exciting, at least fascinating. So if you have stories you'd like to share, give us a call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
You ever try medical marijuana? Did it work for you? Did it not work for you? I'm curious about the contrarians, you know, the, oh, no, it didn't work for me message, too. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Elizabeth Warren zeroing in on the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. That's interesting. Anyhow, your story, I'm curious. You know, it's the season for festivity. I don't know how that ties in a pot. Because I'm really, frankly, more concerned. I think as most of us are recreational drug users, right? I mean, most of us take coffee, take caffeine or nicotine or what are the other recreational drugs that are legal in our society? I guess that's, or alcohol. You know, most of us consume one of those three or two or three, all three of them. So we do alter our consciousness. And I'd say the other hugely psychoactive drug is sugar. And a lot of us, you know, do a lot of sugar, and we do that to, I mean, most of my life, if I have trouble sleeping, I just overdose on sugar and bang, it knocks me right out. It's really not good for you, but, you know, what can I say? And so, but in any case, the recreational part of pot, I find it fascinating, and I think it's much better than alcohol. I'd much rather smoke pot than drink alcohol. It's nowhere near as hard on my body. But the fact or the idea or the concept that smoking pot or making tea out of it or vaporizing it, which seems far better than smoking it, and the vaporizing technology is just all over the place because they're also vaporizing cigarette stuff, you know, nicotine liquids, is just fascinating. Just fascinating. Alan in Williams, Arizona. Hey, Alan, you have a story to tell?
Yeah, Tom, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm feeling better. As I keep drinking this hemp milk, I'm feeling better. I'm sure it's placebo effect, but I'm smiling. So what's up?
Yeah, I've got a story for you. I'm 61. When I was 55, I was in a motorcycle accident and broke 36 bones all at once.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah. And so I was in the hospital, and they said I was going to be in there a couple of months, but I'm an avid motorcyclist, and I went home in 10 days, and I was in a body cast and laying there in bed, and I'm on the lower tabs and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me sick, bud.
The painkillers, these prescription painkiller drugs.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and so anyway, a buddy of mine comes over and he says, "Hey, you want to hit?" And I'm laying in a body cast. My arms are broke, my legs are broke. I broke 6 vertebrae in my neck and 4 in my back and 2 major head fractures. So,
whoa.
I'm in a body cast. And so we have a hit, and my day went from black and white to color. I can't tell you how good I felt, even busted up like that. So, of course, I told my wife, "Hey, honey, we got to have some of this." And it's illegal in Nevada.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you know people, you can get it.
Right.
Anyway, I started using that. I quit taking the pills. And the doctor got all mad because I'm not taking the painkillers. But I didn't tell him I was smoking pot. I just went along, okay. And I had friends come over begging for those painkillers. I was shocked.
Yeah.
And when I saw how people are addicted to them, I couldn't believe it. And but anyway, I got rid of them. And all I do is have a puff. I've got a medical marijuana card. Now I live in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And we have a pharmacy here that you can get anything you want, and different grades, like you said. Usually your indicas are real good for your body. They let you sleep real good.
Yeah, that's what I got when we were in Washington State, and that's the stuff that's high in CBD, and it's got a good dose of THC in it, but it's the high in CBD, right?
That's correct, and it makes you sleep real good.
Yeah, I can testify to that, and I've you know, I almost flunked kindergarten because I couldn't take naps. I mean, I you know, I've been a light sleeper my whole entire life, and this stuff was amazing. In my experience.
Especially me. I'm 61 now, and I get aches and pains after running around all day. And I'll tell you what, bud, it helps me sleep. And yeah. I got another story. A friend of mine, he doesn't smoke. He's in depression. He's the same age. Every time I talked to him, he was just down in the dumps. And I live up here in the mountains, so I said, come on up, you and your wife, come up and have stay up here if you feel like it. They made it up here, and I told him I had marijuana, medical marijuana, and so he had a puff. And I gave him a little bit, and he took it home. And a week later, he called me, and I couldn't believe the high spirits he was in, and he wanted to know where he could get some. Now, I tell you, it's a really great thing. I think it should be legalized throughout the country, and I just wanted to tell you that.
Okay. Alan, thank you very much. Thanks for the story, and thanks for sharing that. I don't know if I mentioned this or not on the air, but Louise met a woman here in Washington, D.C. a couple of weeks ago. It was just one of those serendipitous things, who has a medical marijuana license or card or whatever you call it. Because D.C. has medical marijuana. And she was a young woman. She was in her 20s. And she said that she had ADD, attention deficit disorder, right? Or ADHD, hyperactivity, so badly that she couldn't work. She had trouble making it through school. She was on Ritalin. She was on, all the drugs. There was two or three different drugs that they had her on. It wasn't working. It was making her jittery. It was making her crazy. She started using medical marijuana for her ADD. And she's now able to hold a full-time 40-hour-a-week job and relationships and all the stuff that she was having a real struggle with before. This is starting to sound like, you know, patent medicine, you know, like the guy in the back of the truck in 1890 pulling up to town saying, I got the tincture here that'll cure anything. On the other hand, you know, plants are pretty amazing. Josh in Melbourne, Florida. Hey, Josh.
How you doing, Tom?
Good. What's your story?
My story is a little different from everybody else, but I do have a terrible back injury like you. I've been through 5 surgeries, and I live with a pain pump in my abdomen.
Ouch.
It pumps clotted straight to my spine.
Wow.
That filled every couple of months, but as I live in Florida, and this is Pill Mill Central, there's a law here that says pain management specialists are required to test for all illegal drugs and legal drugs to make sure, one, that you're not selling your medicine, that you're actually taking the pills they prescribe, but two, that you're not supplementing with additional, you know, pain medication.
Right.
I have used pot quite a bit. It helps me a tremendous amount. However, if I come up positive on any one of these urine screens, I will be removed from the program.
Wow.
This is something that everybody in Florida deals with. Every pain patient in Florida has to go through this. Most of them have to see their pain management doctors once a month, which gives you no time to clean up.
And pee in the cup. And because pot stays, because it's fat soluble, you can even be exposed to pot, just be in a room where somebody's smoking it, and you will test positive for it for weeks, in some cases months later, right?
Correct. And that's the real travesty that's going on here. Despite a 52% vote in favor of legalizing medical marijuana, it was not passed this November because for some reason around here we require 60%.
Yeah, that's to amend the Constitution, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Josh, thanks for sharing the story. That's a horror story about Jeb Bush's Florida or Rick Scott's Florida now. Thank you, Josh, for the call. Steve in East Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, man, great topic, and not to boast, but I am a expert on medical marijuana with proprietary knowledge. Okay. There's way too much for you to know just from taking callers' input, but I can say to you this. The hemp milk and other hemp products that you get in the United States, it can't have any cannabinoids in it.
Yeah.
So
this is purely placebo effect here as I drink my hemp milk.
Right, yeah, you're getting essential fatty acids and other benefits, but you're not getting CBD, THC, CBN.
Oh, well.
Now, yeah, you are a very smart man, and you're trying to do wise use of cannabis, and cannabis now is super potent because we've bred it and cultivated it to be way, way more potent than it ever was during the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, what I was reading is back in the 60s and 70s, typically THC levels were 3 to 5%, and now you can buy them in the recreational. Well, I bought some, I saw some in the recreational pot store that was 24% THC. I mean, the one that we bought was
10%. What I'm saying to you is this. Number one, you want to explore that there are many different ways of intaking cannabis now, not just combusting it.
Right.
Combusting, putting fire to cannabis is not helping you. You're inhaling combustion byproducts that produce subjective effects that you might think are a high. Some of what you think are part of the cannabis high could be monoxides and benzenes that produce a sedation effect, but they also produce serious damage to your lungs.
Right, and this is why you should vaporize it or make tea out of it, right?
You should vaporize it. You should make proper marijuana medibles. You can extract the active ingredients by putting your buds into sesame oil or some other oil and cooking not higher than 200 degrees. There's so much science to this, Tom. I urge you to take a look at intelligent material such as this magazine online called BigBudsMag.com,
okay,
where they explain these things. It's not as easy as you think, and I will say this also to you. Cannabis can become habit-forming. The reason that you feel something when you use it is because it's changing your internal chemistry.
Yeah.
If you use it too often, your body changes its own internal regulatory neurochemistry, and it could end up dependent on it.
Right.
So be careful with it, but it is the safest and best medicine on this planet, and that's provably scientifically true.
Okay. Steve, thank you for the call. 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, ever tried medical marijuana? Has it worked or not worked for you? Bummer about the hemp milk. It. Apparently, I'm drinking Shirley Temple hemp, Shane says. Remarkable. Remarkable. Let's see here. Rich in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Rich. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV.
Hey, Tom. I'm a grower about 30 years. I was involved with Normal. Used to go to a lot of rallies and things like that. Back in 91, I played with it as a kid. But back in 91, I broke my neck in an auto accident. And my physical therapist and doctor recommended that I try using cannabis again because they were really impressed on how well it relaxed the muscle spasms.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've been growing. I live up here in the UP, of course, and it's pretty close to decriminalized up here.
Really? Is that it's not decriminalized in the state of Michigan?
No. A lot of people in the legal area, a lot of people moved up here to get away from laws downstate. And that's when I moved up here, was kind of the same kind of thing. And
so the local authorities are basically ignoring state law.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
I had somebody get pulled over from Florida right in front of my house here a couple winters ago in the middle of a nasty snowstorm. And the officer called the state police, which brought the dope dog, and they found a small amount of marijuana on him. And the state police gave the guy his marijuana back and said, unless they look like they're dealing, we don't care. It's too much paperwork.
Wow.
And they let him go. I danced around. I did a jig, you know, woo, the second coming of Christ. And like I said, I'm legal. I've had my card, which is kind of cool. I got it on 420, which is our national recreation time,
right? Or date,
yeah,
or both.
I've had my card for almost six years now.
Uh-huh.
And it's been a godsend. It really has. I'm in constant pain. I have arthritis issues really bad and degenerative disc disease the narcotics, sometimes I need them, but I try my best to stay the heck away from them because of the side effects are just appalling.
Yeah. I had some pretty bad pain a year and a half ago when I had a frozen shoulder. I was doing this show wearing a sling. People watching me on TV were saying, you know, why the sling? And I never tried medical marijuana for it, but I was taking codeine, you know, which is a narcotic. It's an opiate. It's a fairly weak one, but it's a narcotic. And what I discovered was that when I stopped taking it, you know, as the pain went away, I dialed the dose down, and then I finally quit taking it altogether. And there was about a week there where I just felt depressed is the wrong word. I felt doomed every day. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. And I think that was just the opiate withdrawal. I was going through withdrawal from the opiates. It was no big deal. It just, you know, I just didn't, you know, it psychologically, I knew something was off. And, you know, I've never had that experience after smoking pot.
Well, have you ever heard of the book called The Emperor Wears No Clothes?
No.
Written by Jack Herrera?
No.
It's been given, since about 1972, it's been given to every president. It has a $10,000 reward on it for anybody to prove the information in it wrong. And, of course, nobody's cashed in on it because, well, it's a factual book.
Huh. Remarkable. And it's about medical marijuana. Yeah. Rich, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. It is 10 minutes before the top of the hour here on the Tom Hartman program, and we're just kind of poking around the outer edges of medical marijuana as I'm drinking my hemp milk, which one caller tells me is actually not getting me high or taking care of my pain. I just think it is. Don't ever underestimate placebo effect, by the way. Charles in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hey, Charles.
Hey, Tom. 100% agreement with you on your assessment of the benefits of medical marijuana. Scientists in both Israel and even in the United States at the University of South Carolina are doing excellent research in this area, supporting the many benefits of medical marijuana. But additionally, Professor Hartman, I wanted to ask, if Senator Sanders runs in 2016, would you consider seeking his seat? or do you feel your position today as a progressive apologist is more important than any political position, including the presidency?
Well, it's not a matter of what's important and what's not important. It's a matter of what do you do well? Because my experience in life has been that, you know, there's always more important things that I could be doing, but will I do them well? I would be a lousy politician. I would just, you know, I know my personality and my history would make it probably very difficult for me to get elected. And but really, I love what I'm doing. I'm writing books. We're averaging about a book a year on progressive politics and economics. I'm doing this show. I'm doing the TV show in the evening. I'm having a lot of fun, and I think that I'm having an impact on the world. And so, you know, running, I'm just not inclined toward politics. But plus, yeah, I don't live in Vermont, so I couldn't run for Bernie's seat anyway. But thanks for the kind words, Charles. Great to hear from you, John in Tucson. Hey, John, medical cannabis?
I currently have a.
I'm sorry, John. Uh oh. John, if you can hear me, I can't hear you.
I got you.
Okay, yeah. just talk.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah, here's what happened is I've had cancer a couple times. I had testicular cancer in my mid-20s, and if I didn't have cannabis at that point, I don't know what I would have done because I was a mess. I lost 60 pounds off from the chemo. It was crazy. Currently, I have stage 4 small cell lung cancer, and they put me on something. They thought it was working, then it wasn't working. So I kind of knew after doing my research, my odds were I got a death sentence. I take a gram of cannabis oil a day now, and my cancer is halfway gone. And the markers that show that what's feeding the tumors is way down. And essentially, we're starving it right now. We're making great progress. My doctors are stunned. They don't know about the cannabis. They think I'm still taking the 2 chemos that they've had me on. But I don't take any of the pain pills they gave me. They gave me jars of this stuff. I don't take any anti-nausea stuff. I'm fine. In fact, I'm back on my bicycle. I'm walking again after I lost initially.
So wait a minute. You're talking stage 4 metastasized lung cancer, and you've cut it in half by taking cannabis oil?
Yeah.
Is this cannabis oil from a pharmacy or?
No. I have somebody that's taking care of their father who's brewing it, and I help with their costs, and I get the oil, and we encapsulate it in with a little bit of coconut oil inside it, and we fuddled around with the dosage thing, but I've got it down now. I'm down to a gram of this stuff a day, and initially knocking me off my feet, you know. But then you get used to it, and you basically chart your day and get on with life. And I'm doing fantastic. I feel great. I'm having a wonderful time. I bought season tickets to the University of Arizona football this year as to get me through those 6 months. They gave me 6 months to maybe a year, and I'm going for the long haul here right now.
Well, good on you, yeah. John. Keep us up to date on how it's going, huh?
I will do. I'm a big fan of you guys.
Okay.
I'm on WCPT Online. I'm a big fan of those guys, too.
Great. Well, thank you for listening to us there in Tucson, John. I appreciate it. And thanks for sharing your story. It's fascinating. Rick in Eureka, California, listening to KGOE. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, I wanted to share a story. I, like a few callers ago, am 61 years old. And back in 1998... My dad moved in with us. He was a World War II veteran. He was on the ground in Nagasaki after they dropped the second bomb. He was on the ground about 7 days after they dropped it. And from then on, he had health problems.
Because of his radiation exposure?
We don't know for sure because the government wasn't really forthcoming in really being cooperative with any sort of analysis. Mm-hmm. But... my older brother, when my dad got sick in the mid-90s, my older brother took care of him until he could no longer do so. I was in the position to take care of my dad, so he moved in with us. And about a month and a half, 2 months after he moved in with us, dad shut down. He stopped eating, and he was not a large man in the first place. And so after a few days, I started to panic, and I needed something to restart his appetite. So I went down to a local dispensary, one of the first one or two to open in the country after California passed Prop 215. And my dad being of that generation, there's no way he would ever knowingly smoke pot. So I obtained a liquid tincture, and I unbeknownst to him, I put an eyedropper or two full into his tea one morning, served it to him at the bedside. Went into the kitchen and started cleaning up, and about 20 minutes later, out of the side my side vision, there was this figure there, and it was my dad standing in the dining room, and he had not been out of bed in a few days. And so my dad stretches, and he goes to the window and lifts up the blinds and looks up out into the backyard, and at this point, I got smart, and I started cooking. I cooked him a huge breakfast. He ate everything that I served him. And I kept him on the tincture for another week or two to make sure that his appetite had its momentum back. And Dad lived almost another 2.5 years after that.
And did he continue using the pot during that time? And did you tell him? I mean, giving people medication without telling them seems a little sketchy.
Well, I at this point was I was pretty desperate.
Pretty desperate. And, did he continue using it?
No, I just, like I say...
Used it to get him through a crisis.
Right, made sure his appetite had its momentum back.
Fascinating. That's almost a double-blind study, at least from his point of view. Rick, thanks a lot for the story, and good on you for taking good care of your dad. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to be talking with Neil McCabe about chickens and eggs.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
Wow.
the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us, Neil McCabe, editor of the Guns and Patriots newsletter, senior reporter over at Human Events, gunsandpatriots.com, the website. Neil, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. And hey, your Skype is working. I'm looking at, this is from the Organic Consumers Association, organicconsumers.org. The USDA reports that animals in the U.S. meat industry produce 61 million tons of waste each year, 130 times the volume of human waste, or 5 tons for every U.S. citizen. North Carolina's 7 million factory-raised hogs create 4 times as much waste as the state's 6.5 million people. According to the EPA, hog, chicken, and cattle waste has polluted 35,000 miles of rivers in 22 states. And apparently all this started out with a guy named Wendell Murphy, a North Carolina state senator back in the 70s, who started passing when he became, he was a pig farmer, a small-time pig farmer. He went to Congress in North Carolina, started passing state laws that made it illegal for communities to zone large farms out. And at the same time, he was contracting with a bunch of his former colleagues, pig farmers, to construct massive pig sheds in violation of local zoning laws, which he was knocking down at the state level. And the consequence of this was that by 2001, there were only 92,000 independent pig farmers left in the United States. He started a trend that went from state to state, and then federal, largely Republicans, started passing these federal laws saying that local communities could not regulate this. And today, 99.9% of chickens, 97% of chickens for eggs, 99% of turkey, 95% of pigs, and 78% of cattle come out of these factory farms. And in each one of those categories, no more than 5 companies, typically 3, control more than 90% of the entire marketplace. This is not good, Neil.
Well, no, of course, we want these legacy family farms, just if not for their economic benefits, certainly for what they do for our culture and their sort of, that's sort of the roots of America, is these sort of family farms. I think you're sort of glossing over the fact that there were cases where, you know, sort of new people would move into pig country and basically try to zone out the farmers who had been, you know, their family had been, you know, farming there for generations. And I think you're also forgetting the damage.
No, Neil, wait a minute. You're missing the timeline. If that happened before 1970.
I understand your timeline and he's different, but there are also cases where people have moved into pig country and they have, on the other side, and it's been the reverse of your timeline, maybe not
sure
as big a trend, but it certainly.
Well, no, I saw this in Oregon. It was developers moving into wine country in that case and, you know, freaking out the wine farmers. They were building, you know, 300, 400, 500 home subdivisions in what used to be very, very rural areas, and they were bringing, you know, all kinds of development to the area, and it was ruining the area for the wine. But
all those nitrates, frankly.
Well, yeah, I mean, the water, actually, there were water pollution problems because they were pulling water out of the local table, and they were also processing their water through septic systems that were somehow contaminating. But if it wasn't for these laws, what's the word for them? ALEC has a bunch of them that they're proposing. Preemption laws, I think they're called. The American Legislative Exchange Council, the Koch brothers, are promoting these things where it says that a local community cannot pass a law saying that the Koch brothers can't run a dirty paper factory there.
Well, for instance, if a state has certain gun freedoms, preemption says that a local community cannot override a state
right, and
law.
This is what has been happening since the 70s with regard to factory farms. Nobody wants to live near a factory farm. They destroy property values. But, mm-hmm. you know, once enough of these laws were passed saying the local communities had no control, no ability to do their zoning any longer because we at the state level know what's best for you, this has destroyed small home-based farms. This whole preemption thing, I would think that this is something that you would get behind, saying, hey, let's do away with these preemption laws.
This is very awkward for me, Tom, because I think we agree, and it's making me very uncomfortable. I'm not sure, Jefferson's sort of agrarian democracy says you get the government as close to the people as possible.
Yeah.
I do think, though, that certainly the estate tax has whacked family farms in a way that maybe some of the people who are for the estate tax weren't weren't anticipating.
I don't think that you can name more than two in the last two decades, more than two family farms that have been lost as a consequence of the estate tax.
Well, maybe they're all gone.
Pretty much doesn't happen. No, it's that, first of all, it doesn't even affect you. It doesn't even affect you if your farm's worth less than $5 million. And if it's worth more than $5 million, there are very, very easy ways to totally avoid having it go through probate. You simply put it into a family trust. It's not a big deal.
I think that the important thing is that throughout the economy, throughout history, there's centralizing and decentralizing trends. Unfortunately, you know, what happens is something becomes centralized, and then the natural forces that would decentralize it are blocked off by government regulation and crony capitalism and bizarre tax laws that are written by insiders. And so that natural back and forth doesn't occur. I'm always concerned when you have really extreme centralization. You remember the old line, Caligula screaming at the crowd saying that he wished that Rome had one neck. And, you know, when you have all of your eggs coming, what was your number? Five producers produce all the eggs. That's literally one neck controlling our egg supply, not just economically, but for safety-wise,
right,
for food safety.
Qualitatively.
For someone to get in there. Absolutely.
Yeah. 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 I just the bigger is better does not make sense to me. And the big problem that we have in this republic is that because the Supreme Court, starting in 76 with the Buckley case, has said that it is perfectly legal to buy politicians. Now we have, you know, industries competing with each other for the politicians, or we have politicians who are more than willing to take money from multiple industries. Hey, I'll take money from the pig farmers. I'll take money from the chicken farmers. I'll take money from the oil industry.
You're always going to have competing elites. You know, the problem is that you just have to expose it and make a better argument. I mean, there's a lot.
No, you ban it. In 1907, Teddy Roosevelt got legislation passed through Congress, the Tillman Act, which did not fall until 2010. Citizens United overturned the Tillman Act, but this was a federal law on the books since 1907 that said it is a felony, 5 years in prison, for any corporation to give money to a candidate for federal office. And if they do so, then not only is the corporation suffer severe penalties, but the CEO and members of the board of directors and the senior executives can go to prison.
Yeah, but you also had Roosevelt was also, you know, working against companies, and he was basically tying their hands. I mean, they were telling them you can't participate.
Right, because they had corrupted our democracy, our republic.
Yeah, but if I'm going after you, you should have the right to defend yourself and come back after me. I mean, Roosevelt talked about being in the ring, but he basically told the guy you can be in the ring, but you can't throw a punch.
Well, no, that's a lousy metaphor. I'd say the metaphor is that business is a game like football. And somebody has to define the rules of the game. If you don't have the rules of the game, business people can't play the game, and the game doesn't work. And what had happened was that the rules of the game had been redefined by the very wealthy, by the robber barons in the late 1800s, to the point where little guys were getting pushed out in industry after industry, and the big guys were buying the political system. And Teddy Roosevelt reversed that. And I think we're right back there right now.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of good things going on right now. And, you know, you talk about the Koch brothers. It's interesting that the Koch brothers spend the vast amount of their money for libertarian organizations and causes and candidates who are literally trying to defang the government.
Well, yes and no. I mean, they're very selective in this defanging, Neil. ALEC is actually promoting preemption bills. You know, this is not defanging the government. This is... Anyway, Neil, we're out of time. I think we've both had our say here on this. Neil McCabe, gunsandpatriots.com. Thanks for dropping by, Neil.
Hey, good to be with you.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's amazing that it really wasn't until the 1970s that there was even one factory farm in America, because no community would have it. And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Oh, Tom. Yeah, I think the jury's in on this marijuana. It's a mind-altering drug, and that's good because when you're in pain it switches the pain off.
Do you have personal experience with that, Karki?
Yeah, a lot of it.
Okay.
If you ever had a toothache, and all you can think about is that tooth.
Yeah.
Well, it alters your mind. It gets your mind off of that tooth on something else.
Yeah.
And that's what helps with the pain. It doesn't eliminate the pain, doesn't take it away. It just changes your focus.
Well, you're absolutely right, Corky. And Louise and I were talking about this when we were in Washington, laying in bed. We had just smoked some of this high CBD pot, and we were then just going to go to sleep. And Louise was like, I don't feel my pain, but I know that it's there. And I said, what do you mean? And she says something to the effect of, you know, well, I've got this pain in my leg, this neuropathy that's left over from her chemotherapy. And she said, I've got this pain, and the pain hasn't stopped, but it feels like it's not in my body anymore. It feels almost like it's next to me. And I said, there are two ways to stop pain. Now, the first is by blocking the pain receptors, so the brain doesn't register the pain, which is what opiates do, or blocking the brain's pain receptors. Now, the second is with what's called dissociation, which is where, you know, you intellectually disassociate yourself, separate yourself from the pain. This is what Buddhist monks do, you know, and fakirs, the guys who bury themselves alive, or, you know, hold their hand over a candle flame or whatever, and, you know, can put up with, you know, lay on a bed of nails. They disassociate themselves. And I said, that's what pot does. Pot causes our brains to separate our brain from our body in a way, so that our brain is kind of noticing our body, but our brain doesn't think it is our body. Does that make sense, Corky?
Yeah, that's exactly what it does. You don't pay attention to it.
Right.
You know, so if you're not paying attention to it, it's not registering in your brain. See, the pain sends a signal to your brain saying, that hurts.
Right.
And what it does is it cuts that off. It stops the back and forth. I'm in pain.
I think that's what opiates do. I think that's what narcotics do, is they cut that off. I believe, I mean, maybe CBD does that also, but I think the benefit of THC and other psychedelics that are being used for people who are in terminal stage pain is that it allows you to separate your sense of self from your sense of pain. So instead of saying, I have pain, you say, there is pain in this body, but it's not me. Am I making sense here?
Yeah, you see, the pharmaceuticals, they want this off the market. They want pot to be illegal because you can grow it at home.
Right.
You know, and you're cutting them out of the mix. The pot does the same thing that all medications do. It works on the brain, you know, other than the ones that attack the tumor or whatever it is.
Right. Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Corky, thanks for sharing your experience with us. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. And boy, a bunch of people still want to talk about pot. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John.
Yeah, I really love this topic because, you know, anytime, you know, a person can receive care and it's successful, I just think it's a wonderful thing, taking care of sick people.
I agree.
For almost all my life, you know, that often is not the case. And so just hearing these stories, it's really uplifting. But I wanted to say, and Corky, you know, touched on this, you know, that unfortunately, our medical system or our medical educational system, you know, they're not trained to use herbs. You know, they just are not trained that way. And also, there isn't like a standardization of herbal purity, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, it's not incorporated. I mean, there is, you know, certain centers like the University of Arizona in Tucson. You know, they are doing more with that than other areas. But as far as generally, even today, how, you know, students of medicine are taught, it's just not incorporated into their educational training. And I'm a respiratory therapist. I also wanted to say I think that the preferred way of consuming any kind of marijuana would be not smoking it, and because you know, smoking anything, the particulates, the smoke itself, the benzenes, as somebody was mentioning, you know, that can also cause chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And I don't know what the relationship is between smoking a doobie or a whatever you want to call it, right, a marijuana cigarette and a regular cigarette. But I, as far as I know, I think it's like 10 to 1. So in other words, you smoke one doobie, it would equal like about 10 cigarettes. Now, that I might be off because, you know, I'm relying on research that's been done years ago. So
yeah, and cigarettes now have just a mind-boggling variety of chemical additives.
Yeah.
I agree with you, John. I talked about smoking pot when I was in Denver and when I was in Washington State. I was, mm-hmm. you know, these were one off, you know, one night. When we were in Washington, two nights in a row, in Denver, one night. So I, you know, and you could buy a pipe for $8 and smoke it, right? But a little right. glass pipe. But if I was making a commitment to this, if I was using medical marijuana, or if the day comes here in Washington, D.C., and marijuana is totally decriminalized and Louise and I start to use it on a regular basis to get to sleep at night, which, frankly, I think is highly possible if they completely decriminalize it here, then I would want to go. I would want to get a vaporizer. I mean, it's just, why spend $100 for one night toke, right?
But, you know, more importantly, anyway, is we need research into this, and we need to have it now. And I know people have mentioned that they are doing some, but then it needs to translate into education and care.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I hope that.
So we need to teach our docs. John, excellent points
definitely.
All. I've got a whole bunch of calls on this. I want to move along. Thank you so much for the call. Great to hear from you. Susan in Los Angeles. Hey, Susan.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good.
I have a story about my brother, and I hate the hearsay fashion of this, but he couldn't get through to you this morning. Anyway, 9 months, a year before Obamacare became effective, he got a diagnosis from a doctor he paid with money of esophageal cancer.
Ouch.
And unfortunately, he did not have the money to deal with it, but he started doing research and grew his own CBD.
His own high CBD marijuana.
Right. And he started ingesting it with food matter, not by smoking it. Mm. And he did it routinely daily. And by the time Obamacare kicked in last January, he went back to the same doctor for the test, and they didn't find any evidence of the esophageal cancer.
Whoa.
For what it's worth.
So he took pot for how long?
9 months, 9, 10 months.
9, 10 months, and he was eating it every day. So he was getting the oils and the cannabidols and things. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Susan,
he grew himself.
He grew himself. Remarkable. Susan, thank you for sharing the story. We're getting amazing stories here. It's fascinating. Sue in Morgan, Pennsylvania. Hey, Sue, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you and Louise and your staff. I love all of you.
Thank you.
I'm an asthmatic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm allergic to albuterol.
Which is a drug that is used to stop asthma attacks, right?
Right. I go into grand mal seizures for 45 minutes to an hour. My blood pressure goes to 350 over 250.
Woo!
Oh, my husband and I were on a cruise, and one of the stops was in Belize. This is about 10 years ago.
Mm.
And very reluctantly, I agreed. The cabby said, I will keep you safe. We were downtown Belize where the fruit carts are. And he said, oh, you should go in that store. I know the owner. You'll be safe. I walked in. There were mothballs. Immediately, I went into an asthma attack.
Hmm.
So I get back into the cab, and I am doing everything I can to get myself under control. I have some homeopathics.
Right.
So
we have only 45 seconds left, so if you can hurry up.
Okay. So the cabbie said, I'm going to get you marijuana with seeds, the whole plant, with the roots. He made a concoction. He boiled a gallon of water with it. I consumed 2 ounces every day until that was done. That was 10 years ago. I've never had another asthma attack.
Whoa. So you cured your asthma? I mean, literally made it go away by drinking pot tea?
Yes.
Whoa.
Now, it had to have the seeds and it had to have the roots. And I don't know what kind it was.
Right. So this was the whole plant.
And he introduced me to two mothers whose sons had horrible asthma, and they were cured as well.
Wow. Sue, thank you for calling. Thanks for sharing the story. Remarkable stuff. 28 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. You have stories about medical marijuana? And nobody has called so far and said, you know, my doctor said I should try it, and I tried it, and I hated it, and it didn't work. It's like, any negative stories out there? I mean, I'm loving the positive stories, too.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
I guess what I'm thinking is I'm trying to make the show, you know, about the information rather than being an ad for medical marijuana. But it seems like this stuff really works. Minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, speaking the truths of multinational corporations. And apparently today the pharmaceutical industry would really rather you didn't know all about. Lisa, in 14 Montana. Am I saying that right, Lisa?
Fortine.
Hey, Lisa, what's up?
I have a couple of things I'd like to say about the medical marijuana.
Okay.
I've had epilepsy for about 30 years. About 5 years ago, I got a green card in the state of Washington, at which time my doctor told me that epilepsy was the poster child for medical marijuana because it's often brought on by stress and anxiety and insomnia and that sort of thing, and which marijuana directly affects. So if you can alleviate those problems, your chances for having seizures diminish, obviously. I haven't had a seizure in 5 years.
You have not had a seizure in 5 years? You've been using medical marijuana all this time?
I have not. I haven't used it in about 2 years. I just haven't needed to, so I don't do it just because I've been on medication for that 30 years, and when I started smoking marijuana for it, I was able to get off the medication. And I've been seizure-free for a little over 5 years. And I just, at this point, don't see any use in trying anything because I'm not having a problem.
So let me just get this timeline straight. For 30 years, you had epilepsy, basically. You had a seizure disorder. You had been taking pharmaceuticals for it. They weren't solving the problem. You started smoking medical marijuana 5 years ago. The seizures immediately stopped. You continued it for 3 years. You didn't have any more seizures. And then you stopped the medical marijuana. You'd 3 years earlier, you had stopped all the anti-seizure drugs, and for 5 years you've been drug-free other than the pot. For 2 years you've been pot-free, and you've had no more seizures. Did I characterize that right?
Yes.
Wow. That's an extraordinary story.
I would like to say, from a professional standpoint, I am a ICD-9 coder for a network of cancer clinics in Western Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And just a little something I've noticed. Our patients, I read medical records for a living. That's what I do all day long, and I'm humbled, trust me. The patients that take medical marijuana, I've noticed, maybe take 2 or 3 other drugs for hypertension or diabetes or this or that or the other. The people that do not, they're on average like from 15 to 20 other medications.
Wow.
For diarrhea and nausea and insomnia and anxiety, they're just, you know, they'll give them one drug for their diarrhea, which causes three other symptoms. So then they'll give them another drug to cover those 3 symptoms. And then, you know, those come with 2 more. It's just a nonstop, as far as I'm concerned, corporate fiasco with the pharmaceutical companies. They're just manipulating the system. If these people were all taking smoking marijuana for their symptoms or eating it, whatever, however they want to ingest it, Big Pharma would go down in a blaze of glory. And that's just my opinion from what I read at work all day, every single day.
Wow.
This is all about money for Big Pharma.
Yeah, I think you're right. From the horse's mouth. Lisa, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. By the way, when you were taking your medical marijuana for those 3 years for your seizure disorder, were you smoking it, eating it, oil, what?
It was both. I was smoking it, and I was eating baked goods.
Huh. Fascinating. Lisa, thank you for sharing your story with us. It's great to hear from you. Tony in Hampton, Virginia. Hey, Tony.
Hi, Tom. I love this subject. But something that I haven't heard mentioned except just offhand is that THC is not psychoactive until it gets heated. So eating it raw, you still get the catalytic effects with the CBD without the psychoactive effects if you don't want them.
My understanding is that there's actually a precursor drug to THC, and it's something like TCAA or something like that. It's a four-letter acronym, and that when you heat marijuana, and it only has to be 200 degrees or thereabouts, so thus you can bake it into brownies, you can make, apparently putting this stuff in butter is a big deal, and you heat it up to 200 degrees, you know, not enough to boil, but you heat it up, and it causes that precursor to convert to THC. Do I have that right?
I think it's some series like that. You're right.
Yeah.
But there's many people coming out now for juicing,
mm-hmm.
or using it as herbs and salads, you know, because you can eat it raw if you don't want the effect, or if you do want the effect, then heat it.
Oh, interesting. So you can eat the pot raw, and it doesn't get you as high because it doesn't do that conversion of the THC, but you do get a lot of the cannabidols and the terpenes that are good for you.
Right. And you don't get any of the effects. Until it's heated, you don't get it. It just doesn't exist.
Fascinating. I have to confess, I've never tried to eat pot. I have had... once in my life when I was 18, I ate a marijuana brownie and it was strong and I was knocked on my butt. But that had been cooked. But I've never tried just, you know, eating pot. Interesting. Tony, thank you for the information. Tamar, or is it Tamar, in Denver, Colorado?
It's actually Tamar.
Tamar. Hey, Tamar.
Uh-huh.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm actually a molecular biochemist. I'm the chief science officer of a cannabinoid nutraceutical company. I love hearing all these stories about the anecdotal studies. We're really excited because we're offering cannabinoid nutraceutical to the general public. And I've been listening to the last few callers, and one caller had mentioned that you can't standardize a plant, and that's actually not true. So what we're trying to do is offer a pharmaceutical quality nutraceutical, essentially, a dietary supplement that is of the standards of pharmaceuticals.
Right.
That contains all the elements of the plant, so it's much more natural.
Well, there's a bunch of companies that do that. I mean, I take turmeric, you know, just for inflammation from Organic India, and it's just, but they, you know, they have all these claims about, and there's other, natural companies that sell very, you know, standardized extracts and things like that.
Right, absolutely, and they follow GMP protocols. You know, they're FDA regulated. It's just the regulation for nutraceuticals is not as stringent as pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are companies now making cannabis at the pharmaceutical level, like GW Pharmaceuticals in the UK. They standardize their growing, their strain, their specific strain of cannabis is essentially certified to be true breeding.
Mm-hmm.
So you're essentially taking away those variables that make natural things.
So you're a molecular biologist with a company who makes nutraceuticals. In other words, nutrients, food product, or I guess plants are nutrients. Pot-based medicine that's not like FDA medicine, but it's more like in the category of supplement. What kind of things are people using your product for?
I mean, listening to the callers, the previous callers, I mean, the array of benefits is so huge because cannabinoids tap directly into your endocannabinoid system.
Right.
And this is kind of a master control system that med students aren't talked about, they aren't taught. It's not really talked about in the Western world. But essentially, cannabinoids affect CB receptors, as well as in other ways they affect the endocannabinoid system. That's how they have the wide array of effects.
So the endocannabinoid system is one of the principal modulators of the immune system. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, the immune system, digestion, endocrine system. You have CB receptors all over your body in your central nervous system. CB2 receptors are in your immune system. They're in your brain. So they're everywhere except for part of the brain that can essentially be shut off.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you can never overdose from THC, is because no matter how much you take, it doesn't affect part of your brain stem that controls, your breathing and your
right.
Heart.
It's that part of the brain stem that gets hit by opiates that causes breathing to shut down. So there's no cannabinoid receptors in there. It's like we co-evolved with this plant.
And actually, the endocannabinoid system is literally hundreds of millions of years old. I mean, they found endocannabinoid system in sea squirts. They use it to open and shut their siphon. I mean, it's been around for a long time. All mammals have it. There's definitely a reason why this medicine is so perfectly suited for humans.
Right.
Extremely safe.
Yeah. That explains, I'd always wondered why it was that nobody ever died from a pot overdose. And because you can get pretty stoned from it, so it seems like it's a strong drug, but if there are no receptors for it at all in the brainstem, and it doesn't, alcohol works by demyelination. It dissolves the insulation around the wires of our nerve cells. And so it just causes nerves to short out in every part of the body, which is why you can overdose from alcohol.
And you bring up a great point. Cannabis is actually a great anecdote or a cure for ethanol binge toxicity.
Huh.
So as you said, in the brain, those myelin sheaths are stripped.
Right.
Because cannabinoids are fat soluble, they actually sit in those myelin sheaths and they're neuroprotectant. So they can not only stop that damage, they can reverse it.
And this is why they're using medical marijuana for Alzheimer's and dementia?
Yes, as a cure if you already have it, but it's also preventative.
Wow.
So they found cannabinoids block the formation of those amygdaloid or amyloid plaques.
Right.
So they don't even form. So actually, if you were to consume a cannabinoid nutraceutical every day, theoretically you can block Alzheimer's disease, heart attack, stroke.
Amazing. Tamar, we're out of time. Thank you for sharing your story with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Well, that was pretty amazing. We'll be back with more of your calls. We're going to continue with this topic for a while. Although Stephen Cohen is going to be with us at the top of the hour, and Bob Nay with Talk Radio News will be with us in 5 minutes. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Shannon watching Free Speech TV in Chalmette, Louisiana. Am I saying that right, Shannon?
Yes, you are.
Hi.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the medical marijuana. I'm a CPA, and I also have MS. It's multiple sclerosis. Recently, a bunch of Republicans got together for the state legislature and tried to get medical marijuana passed in Louisiana. It was really, really restrictive. It was only for MS, cancer, and epilepsy, and you had to jump through all kinds of hoops to even get it. But the police union here kind of squashed the whole thing because they were worried about, potentially, this MS person can go out and start dealing drugs to all of the minorities.
Right.
So the police kind of squashed that one for right now. But that's really the best alternative that we have as far as all of the medicines that they put you on for MS, for the spasms and everything. They put you on something called baclofen, which has got horrible, horrible side effects, and you build up a tolerance to it so far that some people have to actually have surgery to have pumps installed into their bodies to release this drug timely.
Wow.
Whereas, the medical marijuana is really easy and it doesn't have any of those side effects. But
Have you tried medical marijuana for your multiple sclerosis?
Well, it's illegal here, but yes, I have tried it, and it does work way better than the baclofen. It's the best thing that they have out there. But the problem is even if it was to be medically legal here, and I would get a prescription, my neurologist is just kind of waiting for it to go through so she can
right.
prescribe it for everybody. But even if it's legal, it's still illegal federally. So I could still lose my license to practice if I took my legally prescribed medicine for this state.
Oh, so as a CPA, you're licensed by a board by rules and regulations that include drug testing?
It can't. Well, my employer can drug test me, and because it's still illegal federally, I have no protection.
That's
so
nuts.
They could still fire me because we're in an at-will state, and I could lose my license altogether from the State Board of Louisiana if I wanted to do it.
Wow.
I mean, it would have to be legal federally before I could even do it, even if it was legal in Louisiana.
Remarkable. Well, Shannon, I wish you the very best. I have a cousin with MS. It's a real challenging disease.
Yeah, it can be, and it would be so much easier if you would just let the people use what actually helps them the best with the least amount of side effects. Because God knows everything they put us on has a side effect.
When you tried medical marijuana for your MS, how do you know that it was of value to you?
Because I was in the hospital and I was spasming for 5 days in a row, and as soon as I took it, I stopped. Even though I had been on the baclofen and it wasn't doing anything, I was in so much pain, I couldn't move and I was screaming.
Wow!
But then as soon as I took it, it stopped and it went away while I was on the other drug that was supposed to stop it.
Wow! Would you smoke it or take an infusion or a vapor, or how did you take it?
I smoked it because that's the only thing we can really get. I've tried it once before in an edible, and I really didn't like it because I think they just use a lower grade of
right.
pot in it.
Right.
And it just kind of made me paranoid, and it didn't really do what I needed it to do.
Yeah, and you don't know right away how much you've taken. Yeah.
Right, well, and there are all those different kinds, and for each different disease, there's a different level.
A different variety, yeah. Yeah, I got Shannon, we're out of time, but thank you for sharing your story with us. Great to hear from you. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat.com and free-don.org. And on the free-don.org, the judge has decided not to let Don Siegelman out of jail. You need to check out free-don.org on that, and then with Goats for the Old Goat.com. Of course, Ellen is offering these little hearts, these glass crystal hearts for people made by women who saw a family member murdered in front of them. It's a PTSD treatment. It's extraordinary. Bob Ney is with us, the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Congressman, how are you?
Good, Tom. How are you?
I am well, thank you. So what's going on in the world?
Well, there used to be the saying, as you know, in politics, lame duck session.
Yeah.
I think that's evaporated when it comes to the White House after... You look what's happened with the immigration, the funding bill that's gone through, and now Cuba.
Yeah.
So the talk of the town is Cuba, and so many things have changed. The dynamics of this entire Cuba debate have changed. Now there's questions raised, well, why didn't the White House, bring Congress in and brief Congress on it? Well, had they done that, there wouldn't have been an announcement.
Right.
And, president has every ability to do the path that he did. But it remains the fact that the president can turn our interest section in Cuba, which we have a building. We've always had the building. We have actual people down there and have had them down there working for, certain things where you had a certain process of visas and medical equipment, et cetera. And that can be turned into an embassy. It would be very difficult for anybody to stop the president from doing that. It looks, Tom, as if there will be a formal... most likely around April, discussions about a formal invite for President Castro, Raul Castro, to come to America, come here. I think that's a possibility. White House hasn't confirmed that, but I think that's a possibility.
Remarkable.
That might happen.
Remarkable.
And Rand Paul came out and praised the actions of President Obama. Of course, Senator Rubio has gone the other direction, as Senator Menendez from the Democratic side, but you have, a mixed bag of opinion. I think the most telling thing, though, that has changed from my days in Congress is the reaction in Florida. The quote, old base of the hardliners who felt they could actually bring Castro down by totally isolating the country, most of those individuals are not in the position, Tom, that they were in years back. The younger Cuban-Americans are delighted by this. They'll get to see.
Well, here's what I think is at the core of this, Bob, and you can reality check this for me. Back in the 90s, Lamar Walder and I started working on a book that ultimately became Ultimate Sacrifice and then Legacy of Secrecy, two books we wrote about the assassination of John Kennedy. And I went down to Florida and I interviewed a whole bunch of people who were involved with the Bay of Pigs. Uh-huh. And, you know, back in 59 and 60 and 61, you know, when Nixon first put that thing together as an October surprise for the election of 1960 that ultimately didn't end up happening and Kennedy inherited it. So I was talking to these guys who in 1990 were old Cubans, right? And at least a third of them told me the story that they owned land in Cuba that they had to leave behind when they fled the communists. And someday when those Castro brothers fall, I'm going to go back and I'm going to get my family house back. I'm going to go back and I'm going to get my family farm back. I'm going to go back and I'm going to get my business back. I used to own that building. I still have a legal claim to it. Those people are dying off. And the new generation coming up is not looking at Cuba like we've got to take down the government so I can get my property back. Correct. Instead, they're just looking at, hey, my relatives. Sure. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I agree 100%. And this was not about a hostage swap. Now, the hostage swap had to occur because that was the ice on the cake and for a lot of other reasons had to occur. But this wasn't done because President Obama swapped hostages and then made a deal. This was done because the president feels this is the right way to do things and the right way to help the Cuban people and bring them back into the world civilization. And I think you're 100% correct. The young Cubans, they have cousins, you know, they have grandparents, they have...
And they have no property claims.
Yeah, this isn't a property deal. And there have been such restrictive measures over the years. When we tried to free it up before about, you know, you could send more money. Charlie Rangel had led that debate when I was in the House. You could send more money to relatives, and people would stand up and say, you're helping Castro. No, this was money that was going to people's, you know, parents and siblings and cousins.
Right.
And you can send money anywhere around the world to help people, except you're very restricted with Cuba. So this is about, I think, humanity and civility and relatives and care, and I agree that the whole property, getting my hotel back or whatever, that's gone by the wayside over the years, so just as long as the 50 years have passed.
I think they're dying off. At least maybe as many as 90% of the guys that I interviewed in the 90s, and some of them were like, you know, major, a couple of them were like professional hitmen. You know, these were serious, some of them serious bad actors, some of them serious good actors, but they were serious actors on the stage of anti-Cuban activity, are dead. When we wrote Unequal Protection back 10, 12, 15 years ago, something like that, the first draft of it, we had to omit a whole bunch of names because people were still alive. We didn't want to deal with litigation. The most recent edition of the book, I don't think that there's even two names that we had to redact because all those people have died.
Right. And also, when it comes to, and I saw the statements by Speaker Boehner, you know, condemning what the president did, but the business community, who, you know, he's endeared to, will give a little bit of what they're coming out publicly, Tom Donahue, the Chamber of Commerce, et cetera, trade groups saying, you know, they want this to happen. They want the embargo to go away.
Sure, we can make money down there.
They can make money. Now, I don't honestly think with the 11.7 million people and their incomes that you're going to have a Starbucks on every corner, but that's okay in the sense that the business community is going to go to John Boehner. John Boehner, in his typical style, will say, hey, let this sit a little bit. And then one day, quote, violate the Hastert rule, which really doesn't exist, where supposedly you have to have Republican votes, throw this open.
Right.
And if they do, it'll pass.
As he just did with the Cromnibus.
Exactly.
Yeah, there you go. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Bob, Congressman Ney, the author of Sideswipe, a fascinating book about what really goes on in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And just a little bit of late-breaking news we'll probably have to get into in more depth tomorrow. But Peter Shumlin, the Democratic governor of Vermont, who ran and won on a platform of instituting single-payer health care in that state, something that is allowed under Obamacare starting at the end of next year, just announced today that he's abandoning the single-payer health care system in Vermont because to fund it would require raising taxes and apparent, you know, about 11% employer tax and 9% payroll tax. And apparently that's a bridge too far, even in Vermont. So anyhow, we'll keep an eye on this and I'll keep you up to date on it. But in the meantime, there is so much going on that has to do with Russia that I really wanted to get Professor Stephen Cohen back on. Contributing editor to The Nation, professor emeritus of Russian studies and politics at NYU and Princeton. Stephen's book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War, is now available in paperback. And Professor Cohen, welcome back to the program.
Tom, many thanks.
Thanks so much for joining us. I don't know where to start. The price of oil collapsing, 6 months ago, there was an article that I saw that indicated that I think it was Petrobras, the Russian oil company, had just cut a deal with the Cuban government to explore oil in Cuba. That, I'm assuming, is at risk now as a result of the Cuba change. There's all, you know, the Russian economy collapsed. What's going on?
Well, that's a general question. I'm not sure Petrobras is a Russian company. You may be right.
I'll have to find the article while we're talking.
Yeah, I think it's a Latin American country.
Yeah.
You know, Tom, we haven't talked in a long time. Maybe you'll let me just summarize.
Please.
What's happened since we began to talk, which was early this year, back in February, I think, and up to today. I said in February, when the crisis began in Ukraine, when the elected government, the president, was overthrown, and a kind of street government with representatives in the parliament came to power, and that coup was endorsed by the United States, and that remains the government in Kiev today. I said that what had begun as a political dispute over whether Ukraine should sign a free trade agreement with Europe or maintain its traditional economic ties with Russia, a perfectly legitimate debate, a political debate, became a civil war. Because Ukraine is an inherently divided country, part tilting toward Russia, part toward the West. And I said to you, the danger is that civil war will become a proxy war, with the United States supporting Kiev and the Russians supporting the eastern provinces of Ukraine. And that happened.
Yes.
And then the civil war became horrible. About 5,000 people have died. The infrastructure of the eastern Donbass, which is really the industrial, metallurgical, natural ore deposit center of Ukraine, has been terribly damaged. And about 1 million Ukrainians have been made into refugees. I think about 800,000 going to Russia, the others trying to find shelter elsewhere in Ukraine. So what I foresaw happened. We entered into a new, and I think in some ways more dangerous, Cold War with Russia. But now we have something potentially worse. We'll leave aside the Russian reaction for the moment. But as you know, last week, or in recent weeks, both houses of Congress have passed bills and resolutions They are essentially declarations of Cold War against Russia. And they passed, I think there were 10 no votes in the House, and the Senate report was that it was passed unanimously. I don't know whether everyone was there, though I don't know whether a couple of the Democrats who might challenge Hillary Clinton voted or abstained or didn't feel well that day. I just don't know. I haven't seen the roll call. But these bills, which now Obama has said he would sign, are not only a declaration of Cold War, but hot war against Russia, military, political, and economic. They are harsh, inflammatory, almost entirely uninformed, reckless acts of legislation. I don't think Obama wants to sign them, though he has discretion as to whether or not to implement, for example, new sanctions or whether to give more weapons to Kiev. He has some discretion. But these resolutions passed with such an overwhelming majority that they're veto-proof. And he's not known for, you know, the courage of a lion in these corners. So he will sign them. But we have an odd thing. We have bills from Congress that the president will sign, essentially urging Kiev to resume the war against eastern Ukraine. But meanwhile, Secretary of State Kerry, and presumably therefore President Obama, have told Russian President Putin that if he maintains the existing ceasefire in eastern Ukraine, we, the United States and Europe, may remove the sanctions, economic sanctions against Russia. So you could look at this in a number of ways. Utter madness, and that usually leads to war. You could look at it as a struggle in Washington. There's a war party that got this stuff through Congress, and Obama's going to cave, or he can't avoid it, but really isn't going to do anything, or maybe he is. A conflict in Washington. Or a determination by the White House and the Congress for a kind of ultimate showdown with Putin's Russia. That's where I think we are as we approach the new year. And I think in a few days we may know a lot more because, and I'll stop here, the Ukraine we support, the government of Kiev, which embraces the central and western provinces of Ukraine, is virtually spitting distance from complete, total economic, financial collapse. Kiev needs $15 billion yesterday to pay its debts, debts of the government, the debts of the corporations, the debts of its bank. And for all the inflammatory support that the United States, the IMF, and Europe is giving the Kiev government, it ain't giving it anywhere near $15 billion. So imagine if this very large European country just melts down. It shuts down economically. Pensioners can't be paid. Soldiers can't be paid. Unemployment soars. And I need to add one more thing. The Prime Minister of Russia, Dmitry Medvedev, who sat in for Putin for 4 years when he had to leave the presidency, constitutional reasons, published an article 2 days ago which said that Russia is now prepared to act economically in a way it has not against Ukraine. One of the things he said they could do is between 3 and 6 million, think about this, Tom, 3 and 6 million Ukrainians out of a nation of 40 million work for their livelihoods inside Russia and send their earnings home to support their families in Ukraine. Medvedev said, if this continues, we will send them home. So you will immediately have 3 to 6 million newly unemployed people in Ukraine. It will be that along with the ongoing financial meltdown.
And the loss of revenue.
Far exceed anything that happened in Greece or all the other economic crises that have beset the European Union. So we are at... That's a long-winded hello, but we are at a historic, potentially fateful, tragic crossroads.
Right. And that's with regard to Ukraine potentially.
That's the good news.
Yeah, that's with regard to Ukraine potentially collapsing. I mean, I'm seeing stories about Russia potentially collapsing. Let's continue this conversation. Professor Stephen Cohen is with us, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at both NYU and Princeton. His book, The Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War, is now available in paperback. Contributing editor to TheNation.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with Professor Cohen right after this. So, Professor Cohen, meanwhile, Russia, the ruble is disintegrating. This has the potential to be this contagion that's the consequence of the collapse of oil prices. The bond markets internationally are starting to get flaky. The Saudi oil minister came out today and said this price drop is only temporary. I think he was trying to prevent basically a worldwide crash, but it seems to be starting in Russia. What's with that?
There is absolutely no doubt that Russia is on the verge of an economic crisis. Russia has lived on the revenues sold abroad of its oil and its natural gas. And as you said, oil prices have gone from, I guess, 2-3 months ago, about $100 a unit, down, and I don't know what it is, but it was 60 or so.
Yeah, 63 bucks this morning, I think.
All right, so a couple of days ago. Most economists in Russia, the Russian budget had been living on $100 a barrel, paying its bill, its army, its pensioners, new investment, all the rest, on about $100 a barrel. But most economists in Russia thought that $80 a barrel would be short of a crisis. So they're in crisis territory. The first thing to be said is that this is very bad for Russia. But what is Russia? Russia is the elite, the rich, and the oligarchs. It will not affect them whatsoever. Sanctions, wherever you direct them, ultimately hit ordinary people. I mean, there aren't any ordinary people, but unprivileged people,
right,
put it like that. So for all those Americans who swear they're going to save the poor Russian people from Putin, they are now punishing the Russian people. Added to that, though, is it won't work because Russians aren't like Americans. The norm for Russia is bad economic times. And when I say bad economic times, most Americans who are in the middle class today have never lived through those kind of bad economic times. Mm-hmm. The last 10 years in Russia have been a kind of historical golden era. And it's attributed to Putin. And the Russian people will not turn against Putin in any short order because they have long memories, unlike Americans. They also believe that the West is behind Russia's economic troubles. That's not entirely true, but because of the sanctions, there's an aspect of it. So, for example, the most recent public opinion polls show Putin's positive ratings as a leader still in the 80s. Imagine, in the 80s. And they're not cooked. Everybody agrees these are legitimate results. So, the second thing to be said is that Russia is not the Russia that melted down in the 1990s. This Russia has resources and weapons to fight back. It has $400 billion of liquid reserves. That will pay the debts of the Russian government and the Russian corporations for about a year and a half. That's not a long time, but it's enough time to hope that things turn around and to find other resources. Third, Russia is on the search for resources from China. It has basically an alliance with China, military, political, and economic. India, Putin was there last week, signing all sorts of deals. So we'll bring new foreign currencies into Russia. Probably not enough to offset what it's losing to declining oil prices. Now, the sanctions didn't cause the crisis. They really hadn't affected it. But it now makes it almost impossible for Russia to borrow from Western banks.
Right. Hold on just a second. We'll continue this conversation. Stephen Cohen, please. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Professor Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation, TheNation.com, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at NYU and Princeton. His book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War, is now available in paperback. And Professor Cohen, we were just talking about the impact of this collapse in the oil price on Russia and how it may affect the behavior of Russia. What are your thoughts on the theory that Saudi Arabia drove down this price of oil at the behest of the Obama administration or the United States? It stimulates our economy domestically dramatically. It really whacks Russia, Iran, and Venezuela, countries who are, you know, not our closest allies, shall we say. And I've heard this conspiracy theory that America was behind this. What do you think of that?
You know, the most important thing for anybody who comments publicly, but especially a professor, to say when they don't know is they don't know, and I don't know. What we know is that during the Reagan administration and during the existence of the Soviet Union, there was a policy of the Reagan administration of driving down the price of oil to weaken the Soviet Union, and it was successful. It didn't destroy the Soviet Union. That came much later and for different reasons. There are also reports that, in addition to the sanctions, because there are a lot of loopholes in the sanctions, that the Obama administration is putting pressure on all foreign banks and governments not to give Russia any economic aid or economic relief or extension on its debts. I think some of this is happening, but the Saudis aren't nuts, or maybe they are, but it's not just the oil-producing countries that will suffer. This is starting to hit Europe. Now, Europe is supposed to be America's closest ally. It hits Europe because everybody said, after the end of the Soviet Union, globalization, integrate Russia into the international market. And they did. And we would need a couple hours on the air, Tom, to itemize all the ways in which the European economy has become seriously dependent on Russia's markets. Mm-hmm. And Russia's closed its agricultural markets. And there are many, many, many furious French, Italian, German, Spanish farmers who are going out of business as we talk because Russia represented about 40% of their market, whether it's wine or cheese or whatever. They're not permitted to export market. Prices collapsed. They're just destroying their crop this year. That means they have no profit. That means they can't sow again for next year. Family business is over. It's also true that oil is a ramifying product. The price of oil dropping is putting small oil producers out of business, and not only small ones. It's also hitting the new fracking industry, which is expensive. So we have reports of oil companies now beginning layoffs, large layoffs, and these aren't necessarily Latin American or Russian oil companies, because lots of countries are in the oil business, on land or at sea. Europe is extremely worried. That's why Europe wants no more sanctions. In fact, it wants the sanctions ended. Because the European politicians who went along now are accountable to their public, which has caught on to what's going on. So the collapse of oil products, though it hits first countries like Russia and Venezuela, of countries we don't like and want punished, it ramifies. So you and I don't own a car anymore, but Americans, it'll cost less to put money, to put gasoline in the tank. But if Europe goes into a depression, and it's probably close, not a depression, a recession again, which it just got out of, that's a vast American market. It's going to hit companies here. So we're talking worldwide or global consequences. Russia will weather this storm. A historian will tell you they do so because they've always done so, whether we think about Napoleon or Hitler or the economic crisis of the 1990s, which was far worse than what we call our Great Depression, or even just back to 2008. And Russia not only weathers it, but it emerges stronger in geopolitical terms. The problem is ordinary people suffer along the way. So if we care about ordinary people, we shouldn't like this. But it also means that the Russia that emerges is more authoritarian. Democrats, reformers, liberals, progressives, whatever you want to call them, whether you're a proponent of representative government or gay rights or minorities of any kind, the only chance they have of a fair shake in Russia is when things are calm internationally. When things are bad, Russia becomes more authoritarian. The other point to be made is that we have written a narrative about the Russian President Putin as the demon. I heard that former General Wesley Clark said somewhere the other day, he's always somewhere saying something, that Putin is the most dangerous leader since Stalin. Can you imagine? I mean, Stalin ranks among genocidal leaders with Hitler.
Yeah, he murdered 20 million of his own people.
And here's Clark, a man who once headed NATO, who I think, or some big American military organization, he once ran for the presidency, who is considered a major authority, saying that Putin is the worst since Stalin and maybe worse. So a kind of madness has come over America about Putin. But here's the thing. Putin leads Russia, makes decisions, and rallies his political class and people. Not in our narrative, because we think everybody should live in our narrative of events, but in Russia's narrative. And in Russia's narrative, Putin sees himself as Russia's savior, the man who saved Russia from collapse in 2000 after what had happened under Yeltsin. Now, we could say, well, that's his vanity. Problem is that most Russian polls think he's right.
Hmm.
Can't imagine an alternative to Putin.
Right. Remarkable. Remarkable times we live in. Professor Cohen, do you think that we've wrapped this topic, or would you like to continue discussing it?
I always like talking with you, but you've got a lot on your agenda, so you have to make...
If you can stick around, I have a few more questions, all right?
One thing we didn't discuss...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We're going to pick up one more segment here with Professor Stephen Cohen after the break. We've got 6 minutes of news here at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back with Professor Cohen. Stick around. Defending America from the Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you, and Professor Stephen Cohen on the line with us, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at NYU in Princeton. His book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War, is available in paperback now. And Professor Cohen, first of all, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you for sticking around. Let me just share with you a couple of... This is July 12, 2014... The headline, Russia's Rosneft to help Cuba explore offshore oil reserves. According to a cooperation document signed between Russia and Cuba during President Vladimir Putin's visit to Havana. This was back in July. And then here's another one, this more current. This is from day before yesterday. Bloomberg, after the single worst day in Russia's nine-month-old financial crisis, the fallout is spreading across global markets. And then they talk about how a PIMCO fund, a bond fund, has been wiped out, and they're concerned that the collapsing corporate bond market, both in the United States and around the world, it's apparently 12 to 20% of that market in the United States is these frackers, these oil developers, is collapsing. What are the best and worst outcomes of this collapse in the value of oil or the price of oil, and the president, I believe, yesterday announced more sanctions against Russia. Where does this end in your mind?
Well, what happened to Cuba in this discussion? You began with that.
Oh yeah, it was that goes into my conspiracy theory that there are basically multiple, the Russia's taking multiple hits from the United States. This, Cuba being one of them, normalizing relations with Cuba will probably push the Russian oil exploration company out and bring an American oil exploration company in.
I'm actually not so sure about that. I know a little about Cuba. I got interested because one of the themes of my scholarly work has been researching and writing about how communist state monopolistic economies transition to partially market economies.
Hmm.
And when that began in Cuba... a few years ago, I decided I wanted to go to Cuba and look at it. So I went with my wife, Katrina VandenHeuvel, the editor of The Nation. We went on our own for a few days because I just wanted to see what the new market economy would look like. And I wanted to talk to some of the top officials who were planning it, because I'd studied the history of this in Russia and in China and other countries. Note this, that, of course, it's an excellent thing that Obama did, restoring diplomatic relations. I mean, it's 55 years or 60 years overdue. Never should have broken relations in the first place. And the only people who suffered were the Cuban people. But Obama did not, because he cannot, remove the embargo, the economic embargo.
Congress has to.
That's congressional.
Right.
And a lot of congressmen, including Rubio, wants to be president. And the Democrat, Menendez, have said they're not going to let this happen. So Cuba's economic situation has not yet changed. Remember, too, that the reason that Obama did this was not a sudden flashing geopolitical understanding of the folly of American policy, but because we were isolated in Latin America in regard to Cuba. And with the Panama Conference coming up, some countries had said they weren't going along with the United States in any regard regarding Cuba. So now, diplomatically, Obama can go, and presumably Raul Castro will be there, and they will meet and shake hands. But the embargo is in place. Russia inflicted on Cuba grave economic wounds with the end of the Soviet Union because it couldn't continue to subsidize the Cuban economy. But in recent years, Russia's come back. It forgave a large part of Cuba's debt. That was extremely important. And you're right, Russia had begun certain not only oil but other infrastructure investments in Cuba. It's not clear that's affected yet. And there are a lot of countries there. But here's what the United States did under the embargo. If a French bank or corporation abetted the Cubans financially, the United States punished those banks of our allies with penalties. And that's what stopped investment into Cuba. The only thing that will start it again, and by the way, Cuba is a place not only desperately but positively in need of investment. There's so much on this beautiful island that would cost not so much to revive and make the island flourish. But nothing is going to happen big time until the embargo and the American penalties. And Obama was silent about that. So we will see about that. How could this end, Tom? I am usually considered calm, balanced. I once wanted to be a professional golfer, methodical.
Mm-hmm.
I think the danger of war with Russia is still with us. It's easy to see the slippery slope, and we're halfway down it. The oil, which, by the way, has always played a role in the onset and fighting of world wars, Russia ultimately is needed in the world. It has so much oil, and there are such oil-thirsty countries that are much bigger and more important to Russia than we are, notably China and India. Had we had this conversation 3 weeks ago, you would have said to me, hey, what's happening? Russia just signed $600 billion worth of agreements for oil with China. What's that about? And India has been, excuse me, Tom, been heavily dependent, and happily so, on Russia for decades, not only for oil and gas, but weapons.
Hmm.
So Obama says Russia's isolated. For a president of color to eliminate the population of the billions of people of the world of color in China and India is weird. Russia's isolated in the West. But that brings us to a question about the oil. Europe is dependent on Russia for its energy, for running its factories and burning its lights and heating its homes. Now, Russia will never cut off energy to Europe, but if the situation in Ukraine deteriorates and it remains, I think, the source of about 20% transit from Russia to Europe of that energy, Europe will become extremely vulnerable, and Europe knows it, and Europe wants these sanctions ended, except for the fools like Cameron, who probably will try to take the UK out of the EU anyway when he runs for re-election.
Right.
By the way, if you want to tease this story out, and I'm taking your show over from you, but it's on my mind.
It's fine.
Not noted in America. If the UK leaves Europe, and there's a lot of sentiment in Europe, in the UK, to do so. Europe belongs to Germany.
Right.
And Germany, both its political class, no matter what they say today, and its people, have very different views about cooperating with Russia and China than persist. They do not see Russia and China as enemies. They see them as economic partners.
Right.
And if Germany emerges as the sole leader of Europe, there will be one odd man out, and its name will be the United States of America. And that may be an unintended consequence of this Ukrainian crisis. We don't know yet.
Hmm.
But what we don't have are policymakers like we used to have who could see beyond last night, people who think ahead. It's we just don't have that kind of leadership anymore. But other countries do, and they're thinking these things. And it's openly discussing, well, you know Germany.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be German. I know you follow it.
Yeah, I live
Germany,
there.
There's a major discussion of this.
Yeah.
You don't hear it in this country. On the Tom Hartman show, you heard it. Maybe you've had other people on. But this really is a moment far exceeding ISIS and Cuba and the others. They are sidebars compared to what might now. Well, it's crossroads.
Right.
There's plenty of time to get out of this. All it takes is what's called leadership. Everybody knows the way out.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what Kerry meant.
I'm curious, speaking of John Kerry, your take on this three sentences from Yahoo News report. On April 22nd, Cyprus-based Burisma announced that financier Devin Archer had joined its board. Archer, who shared a room in college with John Kerry's stepson, Christopher Hines, served as national finance co-chair of the former senator's 2004 presidential campaign. Then on Monday, the firm announced that Joe Biden's younger son, R. Hunter Biden, would join the board of directors. And then they asked this rhetorical question: why would this company, which bills itself as Ukraine's largest private gas producer, need such powerful friends in Washington?
Well, you know, I'm older than you, but you're old enough to remember that at least our political class pretended to care about appearances. But the notion that the vice president's son is sitting on the board of directors or in some high position of the main Ukrainian gas company leads some people to think of a conspiratorial mind, that this whole Cold War with Russia is really about taking over Ukraine's natural resources.
Right.
I'm not prepared to reach that conclusion yet. But why? What in the world could the vice president have been thinking? By the way, this is a son whose track record is a little mixed, to say the least. And the same thing with these former economic advisors to Kerry and McCain. They're popping up all over Ukraine. I don't know if you do know, that Ukraine just passed a law that it could find foreigners with purported expertise to make ministers of its government. Now, unfortunately, in Ukraine, you have to be a citizen. But the law enables the president to give them instant citizenship, and they've already appointed two, including an American woman who's now going to be finance minister, who's being investigated for insider trading by United States authorities. It is not a pretty picture.
Remarkable. Professor Cohen, we've got to get you back again soon and do more of this. There's farther to go, but I've got to get back to my regular show. But hang on just a second.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Professor Stephen Cohen, TheNation.com, his book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Roy in Corpus Christi, Texas. You wanted to get back to our conversation about medical marijuana?
Are you talking to me, Tom?
I am, Roy. You're on the air.
Okay. I missed the first part. I wanted to say that there's a lot more to the psychoactive pharmacology than just marijuana. Back in the 70s, I worked at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, and there we were using LSD as an adjunct to psychotherapy with a number of populations. And I think LSD is probably the nuclear response of psychoactive substances. But there is so much this country has eliminated from even research,
right?
That could be very useful.
Yeah, they're doing some astonishing work with ayahuasca down in Brazil, dimethyltryptamine, DMT.
Yeah.
For example. So it's
there's a program now coming out of British Columbia looking at the treatment of the post-traumatic stress disorders with, I believe, MDA. I'm not certain of that.
Yeah.
Ecstasy. I was in the service in 64 to 68, and we didn't have a lot of the PTSD stuff. And I also know that marijuana was widely used by our troops in Vietnam.
Right.
And I'm wondering if there's some possible link there that perhaps the use of that drug back then prevented a lot of what we're seeing now.
Interesting. You'd have to look at the numbers. And also, there's a question about how much our current troops might be using it, although it seems like the big problem that our current troops, at least in Afghanistan, have is heroin and opium, which is a whole different, ball of wax. Very interesting, Roy. Thank you. Thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. Terry in Columbus, Georgia. Hey, Terry, what's up?
A couple of things. First of all, one of your callers was talking about transporting hemp derivatives across state lines.
Right.
You need to check the individual states before you cross into them. A friend of mine who had lived in Alabama and had a reason to know this told me that any kind of hemp product, even say you had a hemp rope in your car and went into Alabama, they could arrest you for it.
Huh.
Put you in jail.
Wow.
So you need to check every state. The other thing I wanted to tell you is that when you're starting to use marijuana of any form, medical or otherwise. My late wife was allergic to marijuana. Hmm. She was a nurse at Baylor, I believe, and they were doing research on medical marijuana as use for glaucoma. And the doctor conducting the study needed a nurse to go with him. He picked Lisa, took her into the room that was filled with purple haze. She'd never smoked pot before. And they left, and she said, "I'm feeling funny." And he looked at her. Her lips were blue. Her fingernails were blue. Her tongue was swelling. And her lips were tingling. And
wow.
He said, "Oh, my God, you're having an anaphylaxis response." So
right.
If any of your listeners do use marijuana for the first time, or any time, I guess, for that matter, and they have blue lips, blue fingernails, tongue swelling, mouth tingling, they probably need to go to the hospital immediately.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever that atropine, I believe the drug is, that reverses anaphylaxis. Terry, thank you for sharing that story. I'd never heard about that. Appreciate it. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Gene in Malta, Illinois. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Oh, just a second. I have to switch a button here.
It's quite all right.
There we go. Okay, Illinois is proposing, what the heck's the page on it? They're proposing to take a whole lot of over-the-counter medications and make them by prescription only. And
are these drugs that are like precursors to meth, Sudafed kind of things, or is this some other?
No, that'll be included in the list. Right now, you have to have the pharmacist fill out forms for about 5 minutes.
Right.
So it's behind the counter. Now, the prescription only is going to really screw it up. Where the heck is that page?
Well, do you know what why this is being done?
No, I don't see a
need
for any of it. There's a Facebook page called Stop Meth, Not Meds in Illinois. And Advil pulls, Sans Allegra D, Claritin D, Mucinex D, and Sudafed.
Yeah, okay. So these are meth precursors that they're going to try and turn into prescription drugs. This seems to me like the least effective way to deal with the drug problem. We need to just stop criminalizing drugs, turn them into health issues, and give people treatment who need them, who need it. Gene, thank you for the call. Thanks for the heads up on that. Joe in Hamilton, Ohio. Hey, Joe.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been on hold for a while. I will say that I don't have necessarily anything new to add to this conversation. I was going to come to you with a story of a friend who suffers from an autoimmune disease and multiple sclerosis who finds relief in smoking or consuming in other ways, marijuana. And I wanted to frame it in a way that who are the winners and losers of allowing medical marijuana to, you know, across the nation. And the losers, of course, anyone who needs it can benefit from it. Like my friend who replaced countless medications. I don't know. It was a lot of medications that I used to see at her place that aren't there anymore because she supplements them. Because when you take one medication, you need another one for the side effects and another one for the side effects of those medications and so on. But the winner here is the big pharmaceutical companies. If you can grow something in your backyard, which is therapeutic all in of itself, they're the ones who are going to lose out from that. And so when you had a caller about an hour ago say that Big Pharma would go up in a blaze, you guys need to work that into a bumper sticker, because that's the best way to illustrate this exact.
Yeah, Big Pharma hates hemp and pot. Yeah, excellent point, Joe. Thanks a lot for calling and making it. Lucas in Tacoma, Washington. You wanted to talk about different kinds of pot?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? Yeah, good. My name's Lucas, and I'm a medical marijuana writer here in Tacoma, Washington. And,
oh, cool.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about indica, sativa, and terpenes.
Okay. Indica and sativa are species of marijuana. Terpenes are a category of chemicals, right?
Yeah, terpenes are what give plants their smell, including marijuana. So when you smell a lemon, it's limonene what you smell. So indica and sativa are both classifications of marijuana, but what they really show and classify is just what the plant looks like. So indicas are short and stumpy, more leaf and more stems, and sativa, taller, lankier, and more fruit. And so there's this guy in Los Angeles who was doing, his name's Jeffrey Raber, testing marijuana for years and years in his lab, and he ran a mathematical test on all the different effects of marijuana. He put in indica, sativa, terpenes, strain names, all that stuff into a database, ran the test, and what he found is that THC is basically neutral when you talk about the effects of marijuana. And it's actually the terpenes that indicate the effects that you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty easy to test. If you take THC, three strains with the same amount of THC, and then you try them or consume them, you'll get three different effects.
Right.
And so, you know, this is really something we just really need to start talking about.
I just recently read an article that said that the terpenes in mangoes potentiate CBD and THC. And so if you want to get a smoother, gentler high, eat mangoes before you smoke pot. Is that crazy talk or was that?
Yeah, I heard that, and I believe the terpene is myrcene, and that's the same terpene as in hops. And so if you eat mango ahead of time, it actually, I guess, just it gets more myrcene already in your system. So when you smoke pot that has the more myrcene in it, which is more the earthy smell,
right?
It would create more of a sleepier buzz. And this is real easy to test. If you take like a strain that smells like pine and use it, you'll get more of a head feeling to it. If you take one that smells more earthy or berry and use it, you're going to go to sleep.
Well, that's interesting.
So we, you know, just something to look at, start classifying medical marijuana by chemical profiles rather than all the strain names.
Right.
And I have a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/MJIsMedicine. If people want to get plugged into more of what's going on here in Washington State with medical marijuana. And that's about it, Tom.
Sure. MJ is Medicine.
Yes, sir. And that's our Twitter handle, at MJIsMedicine. And on Facebook, it's facebook.com/MJIsMedicine. And if you would like to check out Dr. Raber's work, his lab is The Workshop, and it's in Los Angeles. And he's about the only person saying this, that the indica sativa makes you sleepy and sativa makes you high. You know, that's not really the case.
Right.
So, you know, just people start checking that out and just kind of getting the word out on that.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. And in you are a medical marijuana writer. Is it like wine reviews or like medicine that you're?
I write on just all the different topics. Like I like science, so I write about all the different science things. I just wrote an article on an investment company here, and I wrote an article on tour companies. I'm just a writer. I'm a freelance writer.
Fascinating stuff.
I also own a nonprofit, the Medical Marijuana Coalition of Washington State. We're an educational and information nonprofit here
cool.
in Washington.
Well, good on you, Lucas. Thank you very much for the call. Thanks for sharing it with you, and I hope you get some hits on your websites there. We will be back tomorrow. It's Friday. I think Bernie's going to be here, right? Brunch with Bernie, plus Anything Goes Friday. A great way to wrap up a very eventful week. And we will continue the conversations of the week. Don't forget, democracy starts with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.